And I appreciate you calling us gentlemen. That's the first time today. I'm Bob Hyber. I am the president of Chase Productions. And just to give you a real little bit of brief background on myself, I started out as a 16-millimeter filmmaker in Chicago, Illinois, which will explain the broad A's. And really started out as with an Agra 3 slung over my shoulder doing a lot of field location recordings. Came out to Los Angeles and worked for Warner Brothers for 11 years. And I've been at Chase Productions for the last 12 years, first as general manager and now as president. And to my immediate left is one of our chief resources, both for humor and for technical veracity, and that's James Young, also known as Richard.
I joined Chase 6 weeks after Bob. Before that, I hadn't done much of anything of interest. But at Chase Productions, I found an incredibly interesting place that I get to work on all kinds of fabulous old movies. I do restoration work, and we do a lot of remastering and repurposing of older titles. And I spend a good part of my day sitting in front of a computer, meticulously whiling away at the problems of audio.
I thought that was whining away at the problems of audio. So here's what we're going to cover today, and it's really a great pleasure to be here, and thanks to Gary and to Sam for inviting us to be in an audience where audio is not a dirty word, and people don't go running screaming from the room when we bring that topic up. What we're going to cover is basically some terms, the way we use them, but this is a very knowledgeable group, so we're going to speed right through that. We kind of want to get to the application of analog and digital technology is kind of what I call our production stories. And if we have time, we'll develop some conclusions and, of course, leave times for questions and answers. So real quickly, I always like to define my terms. And preservation, of course, is that technical copying process. There's not what you might say a whole lot of creativeness to it when you think of making a movie, but believe me, as you'll see in a little bit, there is an awful lot of creativity required these days for preservation. Now, restoration, after we've done our preservation work, we're looking to correct the things that are wrong in the recording. Generally, from our perspective, these are things that have to do with wear and tear, so the ravages of time and storage, improper handling, overuse. Now we get into a little bit of the more esoteric area where we start talking about what is analog and what is digital. I like to, I had to come up with what I could put on one page to describe analog. I saw it was a really nice kind of white paper tutorial on digital audio up at the front desk, and I recommend you pick that up if you haven't, because it looked like it contained a lot of great explanation and information of how we get from the analog world where we have all lived into this digital world. But when we look in motion picture sound and really in recorded sound, what are our analog processes that we would talk about? Well, obviously in the laboratory, the photochemical process, making copies. In the sound department, of course, sound transfer, making a copy from one master to another master. The types of equipment that we use, analog equipment with tubes and transistors. And then the recording media is going to be audio tape, film, optical film. So those are the analog processes. And then digital, this required a little more thought, but I was really happy with this definition. I thought I was pretty clever. Because what we're really saying here is that we are going to take something that could be heard or listened to or was in some form a one-to-one copy of its audio, and now we're going to convert it into something that it's not. And we're all pretty much familiar with taking audio and now calling it data. And what would we look at as digital processes, again, in the sound world? Well, we all know we have all these wonderful digital processing statements. We just had a whole half an hour presentation on the Atari system. Word processing or audio recognition. There's some interesting things as I get involved with many of these groups where, you know, it's not so much, it's important to save and preserve and be able to manipulate our things, but the value of all of our collections is not the artifact, it's what's embodied in it. So we start looking at word recognition programs, automated processes that will tell us what we actually have in our libraries. Obviously archiving, whatever that term really means, but there's certainly a digital component. And then I realized that even as we move into the computer world, we have this whole new digital world of the internet, access, databases that are available to all of us, and that's, you know, all part of our digital world. So let's look a little bit more now behind those basic definitions to see what we mean by preservation. We said it was a technical copying process to prolong, that seems easy. So what would be our challenges? Well, obviously, we know the conditions of our elements, what kind of format it's recorded on, do we still have the equipment? And then perhaps to address some of these problems, we're going to have to develop custom technologies now, because either the original technology no longer exists or the condition of the element is so bad that the original equipment would no longer play it. And just to show you an idea of formats, this is actually an old sheet that we had on the formats that were in-house. I think at this time that was about 54. We're up to about 62. Andrew, who is with us today from our company and hiding somewhere in the back, he's the shill in the audience that's going to throw up the softball questions afterwards. He'll prepare a nice little sheet, which is in the propaganda room, and it does list our formats, so don't try to write them down. And then, of course, we have film prep, because, as I said, conditions of elements are really one of the biggest challenges we face. This does not look like a very appealing job, does it? And I must tell you, it is not a very appealing job, but it's really where a lot of people get started. The neat thing about working in film sound and working in film sound restoration is the word film is still an intrinsic component. And to give you some examples of what we see, this is not a display shot from FPC. This is actually single stripe acetate magnetic film that has developed a severe curl. And the film is fairly brittle, and when we try to straighten this out, the film perfs often will break. There is a piece of film that has a severe binder a plasticizer residue, which has crystallized on the surface of the magnetic film. Of course, this has terrible shrinkage as well as deformation. It requires extensive cleaning, and probably this piece of film was not playable even after that. Here we have an example of where the binder has failed and the emulsion has fallen off the film. And as audio people, you know what we call this, right? Does anybody know what we call this? Dropout. That's very great. And so what do we call that one? A big dropout. And then, you know, as I recall as a kid, there was kind of a nursery rhyme about Humpty Dumpty. And this is really represents one of the worst pieces of film we actually I've ever personally seen. The acetate base has become so brittle and fragile that just handling it, it crumbles literally into dust, and all the king's horses and all the king's men are never going to get this mag to run again. So those are the challenges that we see when we are working with film sound. And primarily the magnetic films display this more than the optical film. But I will tell you that in the last few years, this problem is definitely on an increasing exponential or logarithmic curve. Vinegar syndrome accelerates as it develops, and we're really seeing the problem become more severe. Literally shows that came in 3-4 years ago that we could play come in today, maybe for a second transfer, and are unplayable. So to address the problem, one of the solutions I said was custom technology. We worked with the engineers in Switzerland for Sondor and developed a magnetic transfer machine to help us transfer the warped and magnetic sound film. And this is truly one of the finest magnetic transports ever built. The Sondor guys, a fabulous piece of technology. It came out of a box. We literally plugged it in and went right to work. And to give you an example of the problems this will address, this piece of film you see on here actually can be played back with good fidelity. And Barbara, we're going to start off here with audio number one to give a demonstration of how this works. This is Gone with the Wind. It was a 17.5 millimeter music and effects track that had been transferred from the optical stems probably in the 60s and came to us in a very warped and distressed state. So now you'll hear what our conventional transfer would sound like, and you'll listen to the uneven head contact, the uneven playback. It will be followed by the Sondor transfer, where you have a much better head contact. Listen to the hiss level. It stays very, very consistent. So we're getting an exceptional playback from a piece of film that, you know, in the old days, just you couldn't do it. Barbara, you're all set? So you can see that there's a transfer that's going to give you some audio that you can work with.
Before we had the Sondor machine, we actually had worked out a wide variety of elaborate schemes with text wipes, and where the engineer would actually use his finger covered with something and apply pressure. And it was a quick burnout on that. But you ran into all kinds of problems creating WOW, and it was an imperfect solution.
Right,
so we can actually do a whole reel.
You know, I mean, you know, you'd have a bad piece, and you say, well, the guy with the magic finger is not in today. We can't do that transfer. So, of course, I always like to ask the question, exactly, is preservation important? And the answer to that is, of course it is. We were able to work on The Wizard of Oz, a wonderful movie, and we only were able to achieve the results we could because executives at MGM in the 1960s, when this term preservation was not a very popular term, made the right decision to transfer their nitrate materials to safety materials and preserve them so that they could be accessed today. And I always like to remind people that our work on The Wizard of Oz was done from what I call first generation preservation elements because the original elements no longer existed. And in the motion picture end of things, the Association of Moving Image Archivists is a group that we're involved with. I asked Sam if a lot of you here were or if you knew about it. He wasn't too sure. Afterwards, if you're interested, a very reasonable membership fee. They have a website, a lot of good information, which covers all kinds of areas of sound recording and, of course, motion picture and just archival discussions, digital archiving. And if I get three people to sign up, I get a toaster this week. So we hope you do that. So let's talk just very briefly about restoration, which we'll get into in much more detail in the production stories. Of course, here we're looking to remove the flaws of age and use. And what are our challenges here? Well, we have, of course, all of the challenges of preservation. So I lump those into what I call playback. We have to have the equipment. We have to have an element or some kind of way of working, of making the first transfer. And then, of course, we have a whole variety of processing technology, which now has really moved into the digital age. And then we have this other area, which I kind of call, in restoration, archival access. How much information do we know about where the elements were stored, where the elements might be stored? Can we get them? You know, is there a collection in Europe that actually has a copy of a print that's in much better shape than anything that exists in the United States? And this is kind of where the digital age is certainly helping us out, because it's so much easier to make a query via email. Doesn't matter what time of day it is, type it out, shoot it over someplace. Next morning you walk into the office and there's your answer. I mean, it's just kind of like, how did we get by without it? And now let's talk just very briefly about the digital processes. I always like to remind people that when Jim and I talk, and I'm doing most of it right now, but he'll get to it. First off, we like to mention that it's really kind of from our empirical experience. It's not like we're scientists or researchers per se. We're really kind of the guys that are in the trenches doing the work, Jim particularly. And we may talk about pieces of equipment, including pieces of our own equipment, and you should not take that as an endorsement or any kind of recommendation. It's just the tools that we're using today to do this kind of work. So we have lots of processing equipment. There's lots of new manufacturers. You know, in the very beginning of the 90s, having some kind of digital tool was unique and new, and there were just a few choices. Today, they're like rabbits. They're proliferating. There is a whole host of things, and that's both a good thing and a bad thing. And Jim will really get into that because that's kind of his mantra. Of course, there's some that are less less costly, so they're less powerful, so that means perhaps they don't do as good a job. Maybe they do a better job. I mean, one of the real benefits in some of this digital technology for a facility owner is, you know, is that some of this digital technology is increasingly and exceedingly affordable, and that's a good thing. Storage costs. Well, it's funny, when I made these notes, originally we spent like $1,000 to get a gigabyte of storage, and we thought we were so cool. I mean, a gigabyte, you know, wow, we got a lot. And I made a note here when I last had these notes that, you know, it would cost us about $100 for a gigabyte. Well, you know, now, I mean, practically a gigabyte of storage is free. They give you that. You have to buy the carrier. But, yeah, no, you get for $400, you get 18 gigabytes of storage. Storage is almost, is rapidly almost becoming the non-issue of digital technology, where in the beginning it was a huge issue. And then we have this idea of trying to create digital standards. There's the Universal Preservation Format Group that comes out of Dave McCarron at WGBH. There was a big listserv with EMEA for a while. And other standards groups, Audio Engineering Society has been very active, SMPTE. You know, perhaps maybe the only real problem is that when you try to create standards by committee, unfortunately, you never quite get to the end goal in a reasonable amount of time. But we're not going to do a shootout of any kind of processing equipment. We're going to look, again, more generally at the applications. And those were the trends I kind of covered briefly without getting to the slide. I like to remind everybody that, you know, we have these specific groups, but they really are all intertwined. You can't kind of talk about one without really thinking about another. And it kind of creates this beautiful butterfly graphic of how everything really does interrelate. So let's look at analog processes. And again, we talked about the laboratory. We talked about sound transfer equipment or how we record it. And one of the very ones that we come across in motion picture work quite often from the sound side is the analog copying of motion picture images, often composite prints, nitrate composite prints, black and white shows, where you'll have the original print, and you can make a dupe negative with a track, and then you can come back and print that back to a new print, and the image holds up surprisingly well. And the client says, well, soundtrack was black and white, and I've got that along, and hey, I get my sound preservation comes along free for the ride. And I like to remind people that one of the things in analog copying, of course, has always been that generational buildup of noise associated with the copying process. Now, in the image, because of the stocks that are used, and generally this is an image preservation process, the buildup of grain and contrast can be somewhat controlled with exposure, with printing, with the way they time it, the way they soup it. You know, there's all kinds of tricks. But the guy said, well, the track, look, I mean, you see it here, it's perfect. Those little swiggly lines just copied great, didn't they? Well, we have a very good example to show you why having the track come along for the ride is not free. And in this example, we have an old Gene Autry trailer from the 1930s, and we had a black and white nitrate original trailer. And the client said, well, I'm going to make a new internegative, I'll make a new print, and can't we work from my prints? And we said, well, we could work from your prints, but here's the problem with the prints. So first we're going to hear what the sound is from that second generation element off of the original print. And of course, these are still kind of now really not even pre-print elements. And then we're going to go hear what the transfer would sound like from the nitrate original print, which was basically in good enough shape to put on a machine and transfer, as you'll hear. So Barbara, number two, please.
The cowboys saddle up their ponies. They're going to town to have their fun.
It's goodbye, Tex. But I'll always remember you.
I'll never forget you, Letty.
I'm sorry I'm so horrid, Tex.
You weren't. Anyway, I deserved it.
The cowboys saddle up their ponies. They're going to town to have their fun.
It's goodbye, Tex. But I'll always remember you.
I'll never forget you, Letty.
I'm sorry I was so horrid, Tex.
You weren't. Anyway, I deserved it.
So I think you can hear pretty readily that the amount of hiss that just builds up from the generational copying is pretty significant and would be pretty difficult to address with processing equipment. You would really have to do some work to that track, whereas the original soundtrack transfer sounded pretty, I mean, that was the straight track right off the print, right to, you know, CD in essence. And it sounds really pretty darn good. So obviously, in the laboratory part of the process, analog copying is definitely not the way to go for your soundtracks. It would, if the original element will stand it, a transfer of that original track is going to be what you absolutely want to do, because that's where the quality lives. Now, of course, laboratory preservation and doing analog copies is one form of copying that happens. And another form of copying that happens, of course, is in the days of motion picture production up until our kind of digital age here in the beginning of the 90s, a lot of copying in post-production in order to get to the final mix, the final element that's going to be in the show. And Jim had a pretty interesting example working on Patton. You want to talk about this?
Sure. This was, we were restoring a master six-track mix from a 70-millimeter print, and the client previewed the track that we'd made and was happy about everything, except in the main titles, after there's a couple of instruments that get introduced as the titles progress, and early into the main titles, the noise level jumps way up, and they wondered if there's anything we could do about that. So we experimented and ended up applying a broadband noise reduction in the middle of the cue to try and match the level of hiss from the start of the cue to where it jumps up. Should we
so
just
that's
play?
What it is, yeah. This? So here's kind of an example of, we're going to have hiss build up. It's really part of the post-production process, right, of the 70s.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. This was not something that was a problem from transfer wear and tear. It's on the dubbing stage. They started the main title with one element, and then they ramped up another source, and hiss came in. And it had always been that way. It was always shown that way. And this was not something we were fixing that somebody had messed up. This was just a limitation of the way they made the track.
So, Barbara, could you play number three for us, please? You can see a pretty effective fix. Now, of course, reason it's so effective and transparent is because, thank goodness, we've developed some wonderful digital tools to take care of really some analog problems. And that really brings us into the next section, which is to kind of talk about these digital processes. Pretty clever segue. Well,
there,
huh?
You go. I just wanted to backtrack briefly. Equalizing the hiss level in that transition would be a simple thing. The thing that makes it that was difficult was equalizing the hiss level without destroying the rest of the main titles. Because of time, I didn't include where we got into the snare drum, but ideally, the fix that we applied left the music musical and open.
Now, if you should happen to get the DVD of Patton, unfortunately, that's not our restored track. So that how they resolved it in their version, I don't know. That little project was actually for a special showing that went back out as a 70-millimeter print with a DTS soundtrack, and it was a lot of fun. It's a fun picture for sure. So let's talk about our digital processes. We mentioned, of course, we're going to talk about processing equipment. This word processing, audio recognition, really goes more towards what we hold in our collections, archiving, or this whole digital archive thing is the hottest thing. You can't open up any trade publication, any magazine, and not see the word damn in it, meaning digital asset management. And then, of course, internet access and research. And where we do this work is primarily in small editorial suites.
He doesn't work there anymore, Bob.
Oh, I couldn't retouch them as powerful as this program was. But this is what one of our Nonoi suites look like. They're really, you know, rather small workstation rooms with guys who are spending a lot of time in front of computer screens, much like Jim does, unless I get him out of the office on a Friday. And Jim is actually now going to talk a little bit about some of the power of digital tools. So that's where you're going to take off here with, it looks like Lolita, huh?
There you go. We use a couple of different devices for a variety of problems. One of the primary systems we work on is in Sonic Solutions, Nonoise. And no matter what system you're in, there are a few basic realms that we attack problems. There are frequency problems, which this little graphic here represents.
Use that here if you want.
Oh, sure. On the bottom is a frequency analysis. This is amplitude on this axis and frequency along this axis. And this points out that at approximately 60 and 120 and 180 hertz, we have a nice boost from an AC hum that came into the track. So this right here is one fabulous tool that we have, the ability to graphically represent the frequencies that are a problem. Then we have two versions of the same piece of audio. This is just some ambient tape hiss, but as you can see, before it's filtered, the hum is quite noticeably modulated in with the program. And after it's filtered, we have nothing but the nice ambient air of the room and the tape hiss. So in the digital domain, we can deal with frequency-related problems very specifically with the filters that we have available and the tools to focus in on what the problems are. We can very narrowly go in and choose to surgically excise those frequencies that are problematic that we want to get rid of. We have a new system we're working with right now, the Audio Cube, which has developed smart filters that will not only track frequencies as they fluctuate, but will also do variable reduction to the point where it'll only reduce the noted problem frequencies to where they're masked by surrounding program. And that can be another benefit in trying to leave the remaining audio untouched. The whole crux of what we try and do is to not ruin the audio. If you're going to take all the life out of the cellos by filtering out the AC hum, then it's not an acceptable fix. So whatever we can do to make as narrow an impact on the program as possible and address just the problems is what we'll do.
We've got an example of that, too.
Well, let's play the example. This is this an M&E from Lolita?
That's Lolita, yeah. And what we've done here is we've accentuated the hum on the befores to make sure you guys all hear it, but this is a pretty sophisticated audio crowd, so I probably didn't need to do that. But the hum is has been pushed up about plus 12 dB, just to make sure you guys are all here. I think you guys will. You can tell, sometimes we get to some audiences that aren't too audio knowledgeable. So Barbara, can we hear number 4?
It was there to begin with. The other big realm of problems that we encounter are transient anomalies. And you get this off of the Vitaphone discs. Everybody's familiar with the kinds of clicks and pops that your records will develop over time, because most of this crowd looks like you're familiar with vinyl. Well, we've actually worked on soundtracks off of Vitaphone. We've got one we can play later. And you get the same kinds of problems in optical soundtracks that are dirty or scratched or otherwise abused.
Spliced,
all kinds of things. And the repair of transient anomalies is something that is really unique, I think, to the digital domain. There's math that these people who write these programs have come up with math that's mind-blowing. The top, as I'm pointing, let's use this cursor, the top panel represents how a computer program or an operator such as myself or yourself might be able to identify the fact that this this waveform doesn't fit with the rest of the program. And so there are automated processes where the program will cruise through the waveform, and when it finds something like this, it'll perform an interpolation. In other words, it'll identify the beginning and the end of the problem, and then it'll just analyze the audio outside the problem and start spewing numbers and creating audio. And the interpolation process, there are real-time boxes that do it. Sonic Solutions does it to a great success. I've been doing this for almost 10 years, and it still is mind-blowing to me. I've successfully repaired 25 frames of a human scream, or two or three frames of a piano note, or what I consider big chunks of audio I've been able to recreate. And it's not always perfect, and as such, it's a destructive process, but it's undoable. It maps out the original audio, so if you, and it's also random, so you try an interpolation in the middle of a word or a note, and if it's not perfect or if it doesn't sound natural enough, you undo it and try it slightly different, or try it again in the same place, and it'll come up with something a little different each time. And then, as this panel shows, the lower portion, these pink bars in Sonic represent edit points, and sometimes the best way to remove a pop is to edit it out and replace it with like program, and that's a very efficient and effective way. And that's another area where digital random access editorial comes in very handy. But the ability to remove thousands and thousands of transient anomalies while you're at home having dinner, I'm serious, it's a great benefit. And is The Wizard of Oz the next piece here? What we have next is a three-piece selection from The Wizard of Oz. First, the raw transfer, and then the transfer with just the clicks and pops removed. And then in an effort to demonstrate how transparent the process is, I play only the clicks and pops that were removed from that section.
All right, I'll go in there for Dorothy. Wicked witch, oh no, wicked witch. Gods and no gods, I'll tear them apart. Oh, I may not come out alive, but I'm going in there. All right, I'll go in there for Dorothy. Wicked witch, oh no, wicked witch. Gods and no gods, I'll tear them apart. Oh, I may not come out alive, but I'm going in there.
Quite literally the program that was lifted out of there.
And actually, the way we made that track, I mean, it's just wonderful, is we took the original track, we took the cleaned up track, we reversed the phase, we canceled out the program, and then what was left was the noise that had been removed from the track. So it was just what we love is the fact that there's no program in there that you'd want. I mean, we're not throwing out the baby with the bathwater on this. We're just throwing out the bathwater, and it's just amazing. Now, the problem, of course, is that, you know, you have to have a very high technical understanding. This is not something that you just hit a button and go. I mean, Jim was sort of kidding. There are background processes we do where he does get to go home and the machine works overnight, but nothing beats, you know, a good pair of trained ears listening to it the next morning to see if you had good results or not.
Well, if I wanted to qualify that, I spend about a half an hour testing and setting up the parameters, and then the output file that it spits out, I compare constantly to the source file, and wherever there's an artifact created, I replace it with the source file. I mean, it's not a black box that you magically shove it through. And of all those pops that you heard removed, probably 10% of them were done by me manually identifying and performing a manual interpolation.
But one of the things we're always careful about is not to create these digital artifacts, because they are unnatural. They're kind of really mistakes, if you will, and the bad part about it is that when you create some of these digital artifacts, these are really irreversible. They cannot be removed once you have recorded them into the soundtrack. So from our standpoint, I'd much rather have a pop that's been in this movie for forever than to create some weird sound that is new that's not going to be fixed, because, you know, at the end of the day, 5 years from now we give this presentation, we're going to show you how we fixed up the soundtrack now with more powerful tools, and we'll be able to address that problem. And it's really one of Jim's big mantras, and he's going to give you a few examples of the things that that we try to avoid. And we're going to stay on this slide, and why don't you talk about 42nd Street?
Well, sure. Just to recap, there's the frequency-dependent things we deal with, hums, and sometimes there's in foreign tracks, you get the video flyback whine up at 15K, and there's all kinds of things, mystery frequencies that enter into it. There's the transient anomalies, and then there's and those things are, they're pretty straightforward. Nobody's going to argue that you should leave a, you know, a big nasty spike in the middle of a word in there. The third realm that we deal with is the realm of broadband noise. Optical noise, tape noise, original production noise. And here's where you get into you know, an aesthetic judgment. How much noise is appropriate for a track from 1939 or from 1969? And the tools for removing broadband noise are the most heinous and hideous for ruining audio. All these tools can destroy a track. If you try and, you know, over-filter for hum and you make the track sound too thin, well, a creative engineer could warm that track up with some processing tools. If you over-process for clicks and pops, as you'll hear, it creates audio that's completely worthless, as is the case of if you over-process for broadband noise reduction. Now, in the case of Patton, some of you might not agree, but I thought that was a pretty effective natural sounding use of broadband noise reduction, and we use broadband noise reduction every day to great effect. But I also hear it all the time on, I don't have cable, but when I watch old movies on PBS, sometimes I'll notice that there's a pumping or a complete, you know, I'll channel switch and I'll go, wow, this sounds clean. So boy, it sounds so clean, it sounds kind of sterile. And they're in this big house, but I don't hear any room. And then I'll get my ear up close to the TV and I'll turn it up and I realize that it's going underneath it all. So there's a lot of overuse of the tools, and that's the biggest challenge, is not to screw things up. The first piece we will play is an example of what over-processing with our particular broadband denoise for Sonic, what it sounds like, and you can imagine how hard it would be to undo this. So if you'd play the next number six. That's just ambient hiss that's over-processed. It's not Darth Vader breathing or anything.
Now, some of you people have been with me before. You know it's going to be a tough grind. It's going to be the toughest 5 weeks that you ever lived through. Do you all get that? Now, anybody who doesn't think he's going to like it had better quit right now. What do I hear? Nobody? Good. Then that's settled. We start tomorrow morning.
Harumph.
Yeah, that's from 42nd Street, which is 1933. It was a variable density nitrate print. We had a track print from the original to work with that.
And the problem, as you might imagine, is that it's very seductive. If you're sitting at your workstation, A-Bing, it's like, wow, look at all that I can take out. Wow, that sounds amazing. Look at all that noise disappear. And, you know, it still sounds like a person talking, but he doesn't really sound like a normal human in a natural environment in 1933. Yeah. That's one of the problems. Is just the, it's like I say, it's seductive. So there's a constant fight, and for a while there was a standing order in our restoration department to scrutinize and set the most artifact-free adjustments you could possibly make on your parameters, and then once you were certain they were perfect, back off on them 10%, and let more noise in, and you know, any higher primate further on down the line can put a low pass filter on a track to take out more hiss, as long as you leave that in there for them to do. But nobody, not even any higher primate further on down the line can put a low pass filter on a track to take out more hiss, as long as you leave that in there for them to do. But nobody, not even Einstein's descendants, can undo the shimmery, metallic, wispy crap that's created by that. The next thing, that background process I was talking about, taking out clicks while you're home having dinner, if you overdo that, you get the next example.
Now, some of you people have been with me before. You know it's going to be a tough grind. It's going to be the toughest 5 weeks that you ever lived through. Do you all get that? Now, anybody who doesn't think he's going to like it had better quit right now. What do I hear? Nobody? Good. Then that's settled. We start tomorrow morning.
So you kind of hear that low, bumpy, fuzzy total quality to that track, and again, overprocessed, digitally overprocessed.
And the insidious thing about those kind of artifacts is if they're induced to just a small degree, they have kind of a low round thumpiness that sounds a lot like a naturally occurring optical anomaly, an ed bump. And early on in the use of these tools, we were caught because an engineer would be using like a flow through box to take out clicks. And it would be removing all this crackle wonderfully and, two or three times a minute inducing this little thunk, thunk that this engineer had heard, dozens of times on 16-millimeter Spanish dubs. So he thought nothing of it. And that's the way, until we realized that we were inducing these. And, of course, that was rework done and, as Bob says, a bad day at the office. But we've learned what the problems are and we go out of our way to avoid them. The next example is a real-world example of we ran into a problem, which you're going to talk about microspotting, right?
Right, right.
We ran into a laboratory problem that created this dense sizzling frying sound on a print we had, Springtime for Henry. Sounds like a very funny movie, actually. And so we thought, our client sent it to us and said, we can take care of this. So we tried our automatic decrackle, and they were so densely packed, there wasn't enough space between the transient anomalies for the program to recognize them as individual events, and it didn't do anything. So we had an engineer go in and manually interpolate, and it was incredibly successful. The guy you saw in the picture, he doesn't work here anymore. Well,
we're going to see him again in that little bit later.
He spent 4 hours on Springtime for Henry, and he made 2 seconds of program sound fabulous. So we did the math for our client and thought about, the impending suicide of the engineer, and we figured this is not a viable. They couldn't afford it, and we couldn't stand to lose them because two seconds of program in 4 hours just didn't translate. So we sent it out to another professional in the audio industry who had some different tools. And we thought, maybe his set of tools will be able to deal with it. And quite proudly, he returned to us an example of what he thought was a fine, fine fix on Springtime for Henry. If you want to play number 8.
Extraordinary.
I beg your pardon?
Nothing at all.
Do you want to know any particulars about me?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course I want to know that. Let me see. How old are you?
24.
Wonderful.
So what you have in there, if you heard that kind of sizzling noise underneath the vote dialogue when it ramped up, that's the micro spotting that was originally there.
Well, we'll get into that.
And then, of course, there's that wonderful dynamic flare that was induced. Anyway.
Sounds a little gated, doesn't it?
Yes.
Just a little. Anyway, just shows you that, it's great to have a great toolbox, but, you also have to be a good carpenter and know which tool to pull out at the time. So now that we've done proselytizing about the proper use of tools, we're going to talk about a few production stories. And the very first one is, this is college, which was a Vitaphone project. Hey, look, there's a couple guys. Looks like they're inventing it right now for us. And Jimmy, this was one of your really good shows. Why don't you talk about this one?
While we have the ability to play back Vitaphone, we don't have the ability to play it back with its original sync reference. There were no sprocket holes, and I don't know. I understand they had big mechanical devices from turntable to projector when they showed these things.
That doesn't look small, does it?
So the first thing is we had to synchronize it, and while it didn't drift that much, we used editorial and some time compression and expansion to get it in sync. And as a Vitaphone disc, it had all kinds of rumble, turntable rumble and frequency problems. It had lots of crackle and pops. And we just kind of peeled away at the various layers. We have three variations of this, the raw track, and then the track with all the transient anomalies removed, and then finally the finished, filtered, and mastered track, for what it's worth.
And I think what's really important to understand is, again, using sort of that analogy of a plane or an awl, when you're removing paint, you got a whole lot of layers. If you try to dig in, you're going to dig out the wood. So you have to sort of remove them, one by one. And that's really what this restoration represents. Barbara, would you like
to... Oh,
stop,
Dave.
Stop, listen. Something has happened. Fellas, did I meet a honey today? But listen, listen. She's got that hair like spun gold, that skin you'd love to touch, and them eyes. Damn. Fellas, did I meet a honey today? But listen, listen, she's got that hair like spun gold, that skin you'd love to touch, and them eyes. Fellas, did I meet a honey today? But listen, listen, she's got that hair like spun gold, that skin you'd love to touch, and them eyes.
So you can see, you know, you just, you know, that's a pretty time-consuming process, and it does require layers of removal.
And we like to think that the end result is, you know, appropriate low fidelity, that it sounds, I'm serious, that, you know, it you run into problems when you think, well, let's try and make this sound totally modern, and let's EQ the daylights out of it and noise reduce it to the point where we can make it sound, well, that's a mistake. I mean, we tried to keep it, like I said, authentically low fidelity, right, to its original form.
Exactly. Now we're going to talk just real briefly here about this micro spotting, and this is a this is an actual shot of a little bit of the frame. This right here is the perf. I think we're at about 15 times magnification. Variable density track. It had some interesting kind of lateral noise reduction format in it. These are the micro spots caused by some form of improper processing. We thought perhaps it was improperly dissolved chemicals in the soup that may have adhered to the film when I went through creating micro bubbles. And as Jim mentioned to you, when you looked at this at a waveform, and you're better off to talk about this. I think this is the raw track there, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the duration. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. The top panel is the raw track.
You sure?
Yeah, it's the Duke. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The top panel is the Duke negative,
right,
that I made. The middle panel is the raw track. And the bottom panel is that example I played for you that somebody else tried to remove.
Right.
So as you can see, they didn't really deal with the transients. They just lowered them in volume.
But what's important to understand is, you know, we talked about how in the laboratory it's bad to do analog copying. On the other hand, for this process, we actually have a special technique for playing back soundtrack negatives. And when we realized that there was no way to play back the print and process the problem either in the digital or analog domain, we actually pulled a negative. We made a dupe negative of the show because we have a negative reader. And in the negative, of course, the white spots became black. And we were able to set our range of processing on the Chase optical sound processor. And by making this dupe and playing it back, we ended up with an acceptable result. So you didn't get a chance to hear how bad Henry sounded before. And when you hear number 10, you're going to get what it was before and after.
Extraordinary.
I beg your pardon?
Nothing at all.
Do you want to know any particulars about me?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course I want to know that. Let me see. How old are you?
24.
Wonderful. Extraordinary.
I beg your pardon?
Nothing at all.
Do you want to know any particulars about me?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course I want to know that. Let me see. How old are you?
24.
Wonderful.
You can hear a few of the splice bloops that are still in the show. But basically, that was just a straight transfer before then we did any other work. And actually, for this client, they didn't want any other work. They just wanted to try and get the best playback. They would address the problems if they decided to later on.
Is that George Brett?
I'm not certain. I can't recall. I didn't write down all the things, but
it is springtime for Henry. So if you look up in the internet movie database,
yeah,
they might.
We can let you know. It is a pretty funny picture. So that's again a case where actually making an analog copy and then applying really a combination of analog digital technology to play it back solved the problem. The next show, that Tom is still working hard away. And of course, as Jimmy said, our workstations are both good for processing all the wonderful algorithms that have been developed, and they're very powerful editorial tools. And here's a nice case of where an editorial fix was made. You would like to talk about Bush Pilot?
Well, it's Canadian, and I don't have much nice to say about it. But one of my favorite things, actually, I'm sorry, are there Canadians here? I apologize. Their production is just is fabulous. This is just a situation where all the elements had a big slug where there should have been some dialogue. And Tom, the gentleman pictured, was able to hunt and put together a reasonable representation of what was said there. So we have a before and after of the missing dialogue in the edit that he put together. My favorite thing about this is in the after, there's some great dialogue, the last little bit there.
Now let me just say one thing real quick. You see, this was actually a dupe negative. When we examined the negative, there was no printed-in damage and there was no physical damage. So we have to assume that this flaw that you're about to hear was just an original production flaw, which is heinous by anyone's standards. And again, the solution was not ours to come up with. I mean, we kind of fixed up the tracks to give the client the remaining anomalies to the picture, and it's the client's decision to say, you know, I'm spending, you know, this amount of money for a restoration, and yes, I understand this is an authentic problem, but, you know, no one is going to want to talk to me afterwards and say, well, why did you leave that in? So the choice to try to make a fix was the client's decision to go ahead and try and truly do a restoration, which, you know, kind of moves into maybe remastering, because we're actually making it better than it ever was. And Barbara, if you want to play number 11 for us, please.
So, Girard take off a couple of minutes ago.
Oh, so he's gone.
Yeah, he got hooked for one of those Mercy flights, running a load of serum up to Balsam Ridge. Epidemic up there.
Well, he doesn't know that area.
Running a load of serum up to Balsam Ridge. Epidemic up there.
So, Girard take off a couple of minutes ago.
Oh, so he's gone.
Yeah, he got hooked for one of those Mercy flights, running a load of serum up to Balsam Ridge. There's an epidemic up there.
Well, he doesn't know that area.
Running a load of serum up to Balsam Ridge. There's an epidemic up there.
Well, he doesn't know that area.
Here it comes. They don't make them like that anymore, do they?
So,
and it's funny, but we have another great example of that dialogue in facsimile, too.
Oh, do we? Yeah, yes, we do. Okay, so real quick now, we'll get to our last production example. But there's a pretty good thing where, you know, I mean, yes, analog editing and a good dialogue editor might have been able to do it, but, you know, the time and work that would have been involved to string off the whole show to, you know, mag, which is what you would have had to do, and sit there and hunt around and make test edits and lose the little piece on the floor and have to make another transfer again, just totally disappears when you're in the digital realm. You keep trying till you get something you like. And it's totally easy to go through the entire show, find out where this guy has syllables, which is what we piece together to make those words kind of work. The last little thing I want to talk about is a show called Facsimile, which we just did last year. And here's an interesting example where the only existing element left is a 16 millimeter color composite print. And again, for us, we're sound guys, right? So, hey, we saw a picture. We thought it looked great. And but on the sound, it was a missed print density. It was way too dark. Areas were filled in. This is a picture of what the soundtrack looked like under 15 times magnification. You can see here, you know, these excursions here ought to be clear, but they're all dark because the density's blown. Actually, the track is clashed. We have parts where the lines come together. Let's see. So you can see we needed those proper excursions to be able to get the proper fidelity, but this track actually sounded worse than that, and we couldn't figure out what was going on. And you know, we like to think that we're pretty good guys with transferring optical material, so when the client first gave the job, she said, well, I had this in our lab, and I'm going, those guys don't know anything. We put it up on our machines, we placed thing, and I mean, you know, the result was just exactly what the other facility had on Mag. I'm going, well, now what are you going to do? And it turned out that the big problem was a problem called reticulation, which is where the emulsion swells up and actually cracks and kind of looks like, you know, if you've ever seen a thin layer of mud that dries out and gets that alligator skin kind of look. Well, that's what reticulation is. The emulsion actually swells and fractures. And what happens is it totally affects the light transmission. So now all of a sudden, light's not passing through the soundtrack, and you're not able to hear it. So we're actually, notice this is the blue one because they were in the third generation now of the CASP technology, and we had just had a new version delivered. This is kind of one of the things I think you guys all realize. You're always tweaking around with your gear. You're always wondering, well, can I make it better? Is there something else I can do? Is something out on the market which is going to make it more powerful? And our third generation had a better light source, had a higher resolution, and this was a positive print, but we put it up. Literally, we were stuck. We'd actually tried to do a high-density contact print and try and get a better high contrast ratio from the negative and a dupe, but didn't have the proper stocks, wasn't going to work. You know, the new box comes in, well, it can't be any worse. And here's what we got. So, Barbara, if you'd like to play number 12 for us, please.
We could be miles ahead of everybody in the country. Yes, but by the time we make enough copies, we have to fly them to the plant and sell them at our production station. Couldn't we decide to change in words and language and telepath? Let's change if it would take an awful lot of words to describe a little change like that. And if we
I would translate, but it's too obscene.
Chief, with this one simple little change, we could be miles ahead of everybody in the business.
Yes, but by the time we make enough copies of this sketch and fly them to the plants in Chicago and Los Angeles, our production schedules are wrecked. Couldn't we describe the change in words and then we can teletype it?
But Chief, it would take an awful lot of words to describe a little change like that. And it would be confusing, too.
You know, with all these great new modern inventions, there ought to be a machine you could put things like this into. Press a button and they come out the other end in Chicago, Los Angeles, anywhere.
Yeah, wouldn't that be just great?
Well, as a matter of fact, gentlemen, there is such a machine.
What?
That's good.
I say there is such a machine. There you are.
It's really, as I told you, I started out as an industrial filmmaker, and the part that I loved, when I showed this at EMEA, at The Real Thing, these two guys are sitting there at their table, and when the narrator comes in, he says, you know, well, gentlemen, these guys go like this. As if the tablets were coming down from the mount. But that was just a straight playback, again, when we had the third generation of this reader. All of a sudden, you know, we have a new tool, again, a kind of a digital and analog solution to the problem. So let's real quick come up with a few very simple conclusions. Obviously, when we look at our analog preservation problems, they're going to have analog solutions. We can't forget our world has been analog. We're moving into the digital areas. Of course, I think we've really proven that digital processes and analog processes are totally complementary, and we should try to avoid having that mindset that the digital is going to fix all of our problems. We shouldn't forget our roots. We should know that maybe we need to go back to the laboratory. Maybe we need to look at the physical media and see what else we can pull out of it. And of course, as we know, digital solutions are also going to create challenges such as doing the work right. And also, all these restorations that became digital processes, guess what? They are now archived digitally as well as whatever other material we might have made. Also, we know that digital tools are going to proliferate, and again, based on cost and accessibility, they're going to fall into hands. So we kind of want to make sure that all of us, as we're ordering up this work, have an aesthetic established. Either we discuss it with our engineers or we discuss it with the facility to make sure that we get back what it is we hope to hear. And just like to thank everybody at Chase who helped us. This is not, obviously you can tell this is not something that just gets put together in a moment. And thank you, Barbara, very much for playing our audio cue so perfectly. And we thank you all very much for inviting us here today and sharing with you a little bit of what we've discovered in the world of motion picture sound preservation and restoration. Thanks. We pretty much took up our hour, but if we have time, I do have a couple questions. Is that all right, Gary? So we'll start over here to the right.
Yeah. Where does you get audio elements that have to be synced up or something? Where does
the sync go?
Yeah.
Well, I mean... No, we generally produce, you know, a finished soundtrack that is synchronized to picture. So we'll record that. I mean, we maintain sync reference throughout the whole process.
Okay, so there's
with the exception of the Vitaphone disc, which we just transferred to 33 and a third, which was the correct speed.
Well, the sync reference is, I'm not quite... It starts out either as sprockets or time code. And when we take it into the digital realm, the secret in digital audio is a common clock. We give the files, it's all fabricated, but we give them a time-coded reference. And it's all based on the fact that the same video...
So we'll start over here to the right. Where does the sync go?
Yeah.
Well, I mean... No, we generally produce, you know, a finished soundtrack that is synchronized to picture. So we'll record that. I mean, we maintain sync reference throughout the whole process.
Okay, so there's
with the exception of the Vitaphone disc, which we just transferred to 33 and a third, which was the correct speed.
Well, the sync reference is, I'm not quite, it starts out either as sprockets or time code. And when we take it into the digital realm, the secret in digital audio is a common clock. We give the files, it's all fabricated, but we give them a time coded reference. And it's all based on the fact that the same video burst generator is feeding the synchronization module that's feeding the mag machine or the 2-inch tape machine, and that same video is feeding a word clock reference generator that's feeding our digital workstation. So there's a common clock source for throughout the entire facility. And so actually it's a video clock that's creating a digital word clock, and it's also creating reference for our analog machines. It's the same.
In other words, it'd be what you call house sync, and it feeds whatever your devices are. But it's the key to the whole process, no question.
But
about
we will in the workstation, I will have a video reference of the finished print in real lengths with leader, and in the workstation I will place the sync pop 3 feet before first frame, and we will build pull ups that are referenced to the next reel and put a tail pop also.
Yes, sir.
On your bomb with the wind 7.5 millimeter, I've got a 1/4 inch of the M&E, and I've seen 16-inch, which was done at about the same time as that 17.5, around 1966. And I've also seen 16-inch lacquers that were done in 1948 off of that M&E. If you were having problems playing that back, would you have been able to like use the disc or the 1/4 inch and be able to find synchronization in order to be able to solve problems that you would not be able to do on your sprocketed?
Yes, in fact, actually, in the back, another little souvenir to take home for all of you who are staying over, you get a little tired tonight, need something to read. A really nice article about a lot of that work that was done in the early 60s at the studio where this material was, and I never like to mention people who make small errors. They transferred all that without sync. So all the material 2/4 inch that we worked with like on That's Entertainment 3 was all wild and required synchronization. But again,
my 1/4 inch is not, yes. Did not have
right.
Sync.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised.
I know it's
and again, it's amazing. Again, the digital workstations, the tools that are available, make that process really almost pain-free as opposed to...
Well, you haven't done it, Bob. It's not pain-free, but it's possible.
Well, it's a lot easier for me. No, but I mean, as opposed to doing a very speed and having synchronizers and laying it off to a time-coded medium and finessing it in, which, again, is a way we used to manipulate it in the past. Oh, absolutely.
Whatever.
As a matter of fact, for the Wizard of for Gone with the Wind, I was just telling Sam, when we did that project, we actually went back to the original nitrate push-pull negative recordings off the dubbing stage from the Selznick Archive in Texas. They provided them to us. So in that
but
case, actually,
sync.
That sync was perfect. It provided no problems at all.
Yes, I know mine was recorded off a sprocket at 35.
Right.
But I know
Right, they didn't have the Fairchild, didn't have the 60 hertz, nothing. Yeah.
When we run into wild elements, like I say, there are time compression and expansion processes, but they have byproducts and artifacts also, depending on how much you're trying to do. So you can sometimes get some success there, but you also just have to employ vary speed. Sometimes we will dub it to a tape medium like D88 that we can vary speed, and then from there edit it. I found that, you know, in most music, you can do a quarter frame pull up or pull down, and it doesn't really, if you do it carefully, you can do it without affecting the meter of the music. So there's lots of things we try.
You didn't do the Jolson Plantation scene
for
26,
did you?
No.
I don't think so. Any other questions? I think we got to get moving anyway.
Okay.
Right? Thanks, Gary.
Thank you both very much. Thanks, that was really great.